Good morning. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Scott Cameron. Voters head to the polls next Tuesday for the Illinois primary. In the last 2 weeks on Focus, we heard from the 103rd Illinois House District candidates, Democrats and the Republican. Today, we'll hear from the candidates vying for Congressman Rodney Davis's seat in Illinois' 13th congressional district. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert and Sean Powers talked with all six candidates, three Republicans, three Democrats, in recent weeks. We'll hear from each of them this hour, starting with the Republicans and incumbent Rodney Davis from Taylorville. Davis is running for a second term after narrowly winning his seat in 2012. He talked with WILL's Jeff Bossert about Congress's most recently passed budget deal.
That is a step in the right direction for fiscal conservatives like me. It's also a step in the right direction, obviously, for those who may not be nearly as fiscally conservative as I am. And the key, though, is that we're working together. We're coming together, and we're getting things done again. And if there's any lesson to be learned from the shutdown, it's that the American people are demanding that we govern, and this is a great first step in doing so.
Wanted to get your thoughts on the extension of unemployment benefits. You recorded in a recent interview saying Congress needs to focus on new jobs, not more unemployment or a higher minimum wage.
Yeah, the best unemployment benefit we can give anyone here in this country is a job. And we can talk about an emergency extension of unemployment benefits. And this has nothing to do with the traditional state-run six-month unemployment that most people would get if they're laid off from a job. There's also some extensions to that based upon federal law that have been given in the past. And in fact, since 2008, since the Bush administration, the end of the Bush administration, these emergency unemployment extensions have been going on and on and on. They average about $300 for recipients, which is real money. I get that. My point is, I'm happy to vote for an unemployment extension, but we can't keep kicking the can down the road, and we need to reform the system, too. And this is a perfect opportunity to start to make the unemployment system that government operates work better for those who are on unemployment. We need to make sure that families who are on unemployment don't have to choose between getting those benefits they deserve the most at that time in their career and choose between those benefits and going back to school and getting training for jobs that are available. And right now, the federal government, in most cases, actually discourages people from going back to school because of an antiquated workforce training process. We tried to make some changes. We passed in the House this year something called the Skills Act that would reform many of these antiquated systems and allow so much more flexibility for those who are unemployed to go get training for jobs they know are here and available. I also introduced a bill called the Opportunity Knocks Act that would make sure that unemployment benefits are treated differently for taxation so that a family can choose where they want to go. You think about it. I graduated from Millikan University 22 years ago. There were likely folks that went to school with me. Somebody's dream may have been to be a teacher, but they went to Caterpillar, started working maybe during the summer and got a full-time job there and never finished their degree. If that person was laid off from Caterpillar in Decatur, for example, then you know what? If they wanted to fulfill that dream of being a teacher and went back to Millikan University or came to University of Illinois, if they went on their own dime, the federal government says, you can't do that, and we're going to take your unemployment benefits away. That's why I introduced the Opportunity Knocks Act, and that is wrong, and that's why government should be more flexible and get the heck out of the way so that our folks who are unemployed get a chance to get into the job they want and they know are available.
Well, since we're talking about education, what are the biggest strengths and challenges of public education today?
Well, we reformed No Child Left Behind. It was a great goal, a bipartisan bill that Teddy Kennedy and George Miller co-sponsored and was shepherded through during the Bush administration. But we also know all the faults of the standardized testing that many school districts had been unhappy with and unattainable standards when you're trying to get special education students to actually achieve at the exact same levels as those who are not in those classes. So we made some changes to that, and we passed elementary and secondary education reform. That bill has been holed up in the Senate because it hasn't been able to pass and get to the president's desk. Those reforms are great reforms that came about at the recommendation of many teachers that I've talked to over the years. And we need to stop this top-down approach from the federal government, who only funds about 5% of all the nation's pre-K through 12 educational system anyway.
What else needs to be done to make Congress more functional?
You know what? Congress, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of good people out there on both sides of the aisle that are really working together. And as I said earlier, We actually took the first step in getting back to our constitutional appropriations process. And what does that mean? That means over the last 5 years, the entire Obama administration, we've been working, this country has been working off of continuing resolutions. Well, you know what those continuing resolutions have given us? They've given us sequestration. They've given us across-the-board cuts. They've given us cuts to Head Start that were just meat axe approaches through sequestration. And they're all put together by the president and by leaders of the House and the Senate in both parties. Individual members of Congress like me don't get a say around that table. You have to come in and vote up or down. And you always have to make a judgment call on any bill that you're put in front of you as to, is the majority of this bill going to positively impact your local district? In my case, Central Illinois.
Congress has been criticized for not doing enough to address gun violence. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I don't think just passing a measure out of Congress is going to do anything unless it's a good measure. I mean, not a single proposal that's ever been put forth in Congress or even talked about and not introduced would have ever, unfortunately, stopped the tragedies that we've seen at Sandy Hook and those that have happened subsequently. That's why I'm very disappointed in the administration. I'm very disappointed in the president and the vice president who put forth ideas that only want to talk about the firearms side of the equation without even discussing the mental health issues and what leads anyone to get to a point where he or she has no conscience. We need to have a serious national discussion on making sure that we truly put forth plans that are going to reduce the amount of times that we see tragedies like Sandy Hook occur.
Immigration reform stalled in the House. What should such a measure look like?
Well, I think what you're going to see are some principles that are going to be laid out that will then be able to be compared with the Senate bill that I'm not supportive of. And at that point, I think we can hopefully have an adult discussion on what is able to actually pass both houses and be signed into law. The unfortunate aspect, Jeff, is that the immigration debate has become much more politicized than I think it should be. I'll give you an example. I have many public events, many public meetings. I was down in Hillsborough last fall, had a public meeting, and the SEIU came in to talk to me about immigration reform and supporting the Senate bill. We had a great discussion. Then they knew I was going to another public event in Godfrey. And at that same time I was going to Godfrey, another group from the same union, the SEIU, came to my house, knowing that my kids were home from school, and knocked on my door and delivered the exact same message to my kids. I, as a parent, will never accept bullying tactics like that. And that is, unfortunately, the tactics that are being used under the auspices of passing an immigration reform.
What has been the biggest challenge with the size of this district?
One thing that surprised me the most is that the campaign really doesn't ever end. My opponent conceded on Friday, and I was out in Washington the following Tuesday for orientation. And I woke up that Wednesday morning, I grabbed one of the local D.C. newspapers, and I saw myself listed as one of the top targets in the nation. So my break from campaigning, Jeff, was Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday after the election. The way our system is set up, and in a district like this, which is truly one of the few 50-50 districts in the nation, campaigns don't end. It's not the same district that Champaign and in my hometown of Taylorville were even used to in the past, because we've been in some pretty solid Republican congressional districts. I want to be somebody in Washington who's able to be trusted to sit around a table and come up with good, common sense solutions that don't sacrifice our core values and principles. I want to see us get back to our constitutional appropriations process, not with just one large bill, but pass 12 smaller, manageable bills. Because I don't want to ever hear Nancy Pelosi say again that we've got to pass something before we find out what's in it. When we get back to our constitutional appropriations process, and I'm going to be a loud voice for this, we can pass much more manageable bills that the American public can have much more of an input on, too.
That was Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert talking with incumbent Congressman Rodney Davis. Next up on the GOP side, Michael Fershing of Morrow. Fershing is a veterinarian who ran unsuccessfully for the same 13th district seat against former Congressman Tim Johnson in 2012. He talked with Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert and said one thing he'd focus on in Congress, cutting spending.
We can't keep spending money we don't have and borrowing it. This endless borrowing is going to have consequences, and we have to recognize we can't keep doing that. And the third thing is just essentially the big broad categories the government needs to become smaller. Again, that'd be a big change if the voter population says, well, no, we don't want more government. We recognize if we really are going to have a better economy, government needs to be smaller. And voters have to start voting for that. And they don't, then we're just going to keep trundling along towards the next collapse. Ever since 2008, we've been treading water, essentially, really not making much progress. The very top is doing great, but the rest of us have been slowly sagging. Some of these sags are going to be a lot bigger and slow if we don't start changing what government's doing.
Addressing the $16 trillion national debt requires sacrifices everywhere. What do you have specific examples of federal spending or tax provisions that would benefit the state and district that you would support cutting or reducing?
But even your question has some prejudice that I would disagree with, because I don't think I'm looking for answers that help just our district. I'm looking for things that help the entire country. In other words, I'm not looking for us to have advantage at the expense of other areas of the country. As far as where we need to do some reductions, there essentially is no category where we cannot afford to do some cutting back. There's one category. I would say veterans benefits probably is an area which we shouldn't be trying to reduce that. But any other aspect of government has to be cut back. We're not just a little bit overspending money we don't have. We're way overspending money we don't have. And there's no area of government that doesn't need to be cut back at this point.
Are there other examples of just really of really wasteful fraud and abuse that that stand out for you?
Well, anytime you have government, there's going to be poor choicing and spending of money. Just take the general category of welfare, for example. In other words, everyone likes to be able to help out the down and out, but they also have to recognize that for every dollar that's provided as welfare to someone, there's $2 that's going to government to do this. That's very inefficient. $1 out of $3 is actually being used for the purpose of what it was created. That's not a very good way of doing it. I think there's much better ways of doing it. But in general, government is not a good vehicle for doing a lot of things. We need to have a better focus for how governments organize and where they spend money. So I'm not just going trying to attack fraud and abuse. It's the size of government's the problem. It's doing things it shouldn't be doing.
A couple of years ago, you talked about that the federal government should not be involved in commerce, and I guess one thing that I'm thinking of hearing that is, with the Affordable Care Act in effect, were there changes that you would like to see in health care, or would you just seek to repeal it overall?
The Affordable Care Act, I don't think there's any aspect of that is beneficial to the people. I think it's government bureaucracy. It's telling people what to do with things that should be their own decision. I think it's a ill-thought-out idea entirely. There definitely is going to be people who I think we can't afford to help. But in my mind, you have to have some realistic expectations of what we can help. It's kind of like if 10% of society need assistance, they just really can't function on their own, we need to help them out. Well, the other 90% definitely can take some of their money and give it to the 10% so that they have a life, that they're not just laying in the gutter. But when you start creeping that percentage, say, well, it's not 10% that needs help, it's 30% or 40%. Well, we're getting into the category where over half the Americans are getting assistance or programs from the federal government, and I think that's a bad concept. In other words, we should be helping out the lower end to help them out, but it's not like the upper half can supply the lifestyle for the lower half. I just think American people are much more capable than that.
Who is largely behind your campaign? What kind of donor base do you have in that region?
That's another big category I have, because it gets brought up a lot, because in all my races, my opponents have, not all my opponents, but usually there's at least one opponent that has much more fundraising than I do. My philosophy on that really is that it's probably the second biggest bamboozle. The first bamboozle I mentioned earlier, that our Federal Reserve System is out there to look out for all of us when it's the hugest wealth transfer system, legalized counterfeiting organization we have. Well, the second biggest bamboozle is the idea that candidates who have a lot of money behind them are better candidates. Well, only way you can raise the big money for campaigns is if the people who are in business with government, in other words, the cozy relationship that some businesses have with government, want to maintain that. Well, the profit they're getting by their relationship, they wish to maintain it, so they donate heavily to candidates they think will maintain it. And they definitely aren't going to be donating to me, because I don't think that's proper or acceptable, and I would be looking to end that.
Congress has been criticized for not doing enough to address gun violence. What would you like to see done?
I don't think it's gun violence is the problem. I think it's doing a little bit better of identifying people who shouldn't have guns. Right now we're seeing have an emphasis in identifying who has guns, and actually you're going after the people who tend to be law-abiding and improper about them, but the people who aren't, not necessarily so. And it seems to me it would make a lot more sense to make lists of people who shouldn't have access to guns as opposed to making a list of people who should. Because under the Constitution, all of us should have the right to defend ourselves.
In your view, what strengths and challenges are we facing with public education right now?
Wow, that's a big one. I would really say my view on that has really changed through the years. My family's really been involved in education quite a bit. My mother, a teacher and also a school psychologist. My dad's a retired chemistry professor, and he worked in the university state system also. And I've always thought education is great. I've served on the Aboriginal School Board also. But I see some aspects of public education have really been deteriorating, and getting a handle of what that is hasn't been really apparent to me what exactly what it is. But I do know it's in the category of competition. In other words, right now when you're in Illinois, wherever you are, you are identified which schools you're going to go to and who you're going to pay money to. I think one of the things we could do is to provide vouchers for public-approved schools, whether they're run by government or run by private entities, that they can start saying, yes, we're open for business. And I would like to see where anybody in Illinois can participate and with the voucher from the state and go to any of these approved schools. I just think that would enter an aspect that would really be valuable. The other aspect is that I don't think the federal government has any business being involved in education at all. I would want to end all the federal programs. This really should be a local, regional thing to deal with. This is definitely not interacting with another foreign land. This is domestic, and it should be handled totally at the state level or even smaller possibly. But federal government should not be involved in education.
What do you see your approaches this time taking on a freshman lawmaker, an incumbent like Rodney Davis?
Well, to me, it's not so much the opponents, but what's going on with the people, the voters. And one thing that I've learned by going out and talking with them, there is a shift that's happening amongst regular voters. In other words, this is my third time that I've run for Congress, and I can tell you that the number of people who are agreeing with me that there's a problem has really gone up. So really my approach is that I really want these people who recognize that there's really, we're in deep trouble in this country, to be motivated to vote in the primary system. I still don't think that the majority of people understand that we have a problem, but there's now a significant minority who recognize that things aren't going good, and it's not a party thing, it's a government too big thing.
Republican Michael Fershing spoke with WILL's Jeff Bossert. Another candidate in the race for the Republican nomination for Illinois' 13th District, Urbana attorney Erica Harold. She also sought her party's nomination in 2012 after former Congressman Tim Johnson announced his retirement from politics. She talked with WILL's Sean Powers and said Congress's low approval rating doesn't intimidate her.
I recognize I am seeking to join a body that has perhaps a 7% approval rating. So it's voluntarily joining a very unpopular group of people. But I feel very strongly about representing this district because I was born and raised in Champaign-Urbana and think that I can uniquely balance the conservative principles necessary to hold the seat, but also some of the other diverse interests that are important within the district.
Who are your mentors, people who have really gotten you to this point?
I've been really fortunate to have a variety of people who have played meaningful mentorship roles in my life. First and foremost would be my parents. They are people whose advice I seek on a variety of life issues. And they are people who I would be relying upon to make sure that if I go to Washington, D.C., that I retain the same value system that I had prior to going there. Another person who's been a meaningful mentor to me is the late Chuck Colson. He was the founder of Prison Fellowship, which is the world's largest outreach to inmates and their families. And he's really the person who put these issues of reforming the criminal justice system, going into prison and trying to deliver a message of hope. He's the person who really was the catalyst for this nationally. And having the opportunity to serve on the board of directors with him for several years played a very big role in my life.
What did he teach you? What did he tell you?
One of the most important things that he taught is that it's okay for a conservative to be pursuing those sort of criminal justice reform measures.
I mean, is there this idea that it's not?
Yes. There very much is this notion that criminal justice reform is something that only belongs in the purview of Democrats and liberals. And I see it as an issue where conservatives and Republicans can be working as well, because we're talking about good stewardship of tax dollars. If we're going to spend this kind of money for our correction system, why wouldn't we want better outcomes? But it's also a human issue. It's a social justice issue. And there's this new movement called Right on Crime. And it's encouraging conservatives to really embrace these sorts of reform measures, because oftentimes it is viewed as something that a conservative would not support. And I think it's really important that we view this as a bipartisan issue.
What do you hope to achieve during your first term in Congress?
I would hope that we would be voting on a budget that started to reduce spending in a meaningful way. I also would hope that there would be some criminal justice reform measures that Congress could be addressing, specifically looking at addressing some of the mandatory minimums for nonviolent offenders. I think that that's a way in which we could actually do concrete things to strengthen communities and families. I think that when we're looking at people who commit relatively minor offenses.
What's a minor offense?
I think some of our drug laws. I would not want to see automatic incarceration for people who have a drug offense if there are ways that we can rehabilitate that person. For example, if we're talking about a mother with three children and a drug offense, I would want to see, is there some way that we can preserve that family, deal with that, the drug issue? Because I think that's a serious problem. I'm not talking about legalization. What I'm talking about is not using incarceration as the only way we address something. Because if we're talking about incarceration, then we're looking at putting young people in a foster care system. And my mother has supervised foster care programs in this area, and I've seen firsthand the toll that it takes on young people. So that's a specific thing that I think if we could address differently, then we might be able to have better outcomes.
As it relates to addressing our $16 trillion national debt, what specific examples of federal spending or tax provisions would you support?
The most important thing I would focus on is looking at the mandatory spending program. So when we're looking at a budget, there's both mandatory spending and discretionary spending. And right now, all the focus is on discretionary spending, which requires the kind of cuts that you're talking about, specific programs. But the problem is that two-thirds of the budget is driven by the mandatory spending, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And right now, if we don't address those programs, they're not going to be fiscally sustainable. So that's actually where I would want to see our reform efforts focused first. Obviously, there are waste and abuse issues that can be addressed with every program, and I think that the agency heads, they should be responsible for trying to figure out where waste can be trimmed. But I think right now we're not even having the right discussion because we're focusing just on discretionary as opposed to mandatory.
Okay, so where do we start with the mandatory?
I think with mandatory, the first issue we should be addressing is Social Security, trying to figure out what we can do to make sure come 2033, we're able to still be paying out the benefits that people have paid into the system. If we don't do anything at all, we're looking at an absolute reduction in benefits. And for people who have paid into the system, that is something that's a scary prospect because so many people are counting on it for retirement. If you're 33, there's no reason on earth why raising that age does not make sense. If we're talking about people who are close to retirement, we should not raise the age because that's a very regressive thing to do. Those are the kind of things that start to bring down the deficit and the debt in a meaningful way. And we're not talking about it because it's politically unpopular to even talk about those programs. But if we're not talking about that, the large driver of our debt and our deficit, then we're not even talking about the right things.
Related to healthcare, now that the Affordable Care Act is in place, what other changes would you like to see happen with healthcare in this country? It doesn't seem like the Affordable Care Act is going away.
One of the main things that I would like to see with our healthcare system, and this comes from talking to college students throughout the district, I would like to see more choices for younger people who may not have the same kind of healthcare needs as people who are older. For example, I would like to see greater menus of options of catastrophic health insurance policies. Because in talking to young people, the plans that are currently being offered are not plans that they feel necessarily are commensurate with their needs. And so I talk to a lot of young people who plan to opt out of the Affordable Care Act's mandates. They're simply not going to get a program.
And pay the fine.
Right, and pay the fine because they view it as being a relatively small amount. And right now there isn't a strong enforcement mechanism for the government to actually focus on those who aren't paying the fine. We want people to get insurance. And so we need to offer plans that are really attractive to young people. A catastrophic health insurance plan could be the ideal plan for a college student or a young person who is relatively healthy, does not really have a lot of means to pay premiums that are increasing, but needs to make sure that in the case of some sort of catastrophic incident, they're not open to a financially ruinous situation.
All right. Well, if you do get elected, you could be making history as being the first African-American woman in Congress who is a Republican. Is that something you're thinking about? And really, how big of a deal is that to you?
When you have the opportunity to make history in that way, it's an incredible responsibility because you are representing a group of people who have never had a tangible voice in Congress. And if I was elected, I would be the first African-American woman to serve in Congress as a Republican. And that would be a demonstration of incredible progress in our country. And there would be a whole segment of the population who now looked at Congress as being more reflective of their voice and something that they might consider aspiring to in the future. My campaign is focused on the issues that matter most to this district, but I certainly am aware of the fact that it would be making history, and it's a kind of history that I would feel really honored to make.
That was Republican Erica Harold. She spoke with WILL's Sean Powers. I'm Scott Cameron, and today on Focus, we're hearing from all six candidates running for Congress in Illinois' 13th district. Stay with us. We'll hear from the Democratic challengers next. I'm Scott Cameron, news director here at WILL. I wanted to let you know about some changes you'll be hearing in the coming months. For more than three decades, you've turned to Focus for thoughtful conversations about what's new and what's interesting in our community. We want to make sure that the show continues to grow for the next 30 years. To do that, we're taking some time to envision what those next 30 years might look and sound like. We will relaunch Focus in January with a new permanent host and an even stronger presence on air and online. After a year as interim host, Jim Meadows will return to his role as senior reporter in the newsroom. In the meantime, Focus will become a weekly show, airing on Fridays, and beginning Monday, March 17th, you'll hear NPR's Tell Me More, Monday through Thursday at 10 a.m. Focus will be back as a daily, locally produced talk show. In true Focus fashion, we want to hear from you. Email, tell us what you value most about Focus. Focus@illinois.edu. Thank you. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Scott Cameron. Today on the show, we're hearing from the candidates in the race for the seat in Illinois' 13th congressional district. During the first half of the show, we heard from the Republican candidates. Now, return to the Democrats. Ann Kellis says her experience as a judge prepared her to represent Illinois' 13th district in Congress. She spoke with WILL's Jeff Bossert.
I have just my proven record. I've been a judge for 18 years. I've listened to thousands of cases and listen to all the facts and come to conclusions over and over again. And as chief judge, I was able, again, to bring people together and get things done. I talked about our veterans court that's been very, very successful. You know, it has helped hundreds of veterans. It has an extremely low recidivism rate. I was also able to start a mandatory foreclosure mediation program. I was able to bring the banks to the table and negotiate this. I knew it had to be mandatory to work. So now in Madison and Bond counties, if a homeowner is being foreclosed upon, they get notice of this program and they can opt in. And if they do, then the banks have to come to the table and negotiate. And I just checked our stats. I think we're up to 120 to 130 homes being saved for middle income and lower income families. So it's something that I was able to create and get done. I mean, I've always had an open door policy as a chief judge, and I vow to continue that if I'm honored to be elected. And that is, none of these programs and reforms that I was able to effectuate would have gotten done without listening to the needs of the people that elected me there. And I hope to continue to do that.
Do you see other areas as a judge, or maybe issues going on further downstate in Madison County, your region, measures that need more teeth in them, or maybe things from a legal perspective other candidates wouldn't see?
Well, you know, that's interesting because I did see, you know, my eyes were really opened when I travel around and go to a lot of community centers and see what's going on in programs that they're trying to start, say, in Springfield or in Decatur, where I was a statewide leader in restorative justice and problem-solving courts, and we were able to create, when I was chief, the first veterans court in the state of Illinois. It's that same model of problem-solving courts. It helps troubled veterans get back on their feet and become productive citizens again, because it costs about $40,000 a year to house an adult in the Illinois Department of Corrections. It costs twice that to house a child. So when I go to talk to these people and they have these types of programs going on, but they don't really have a connection to our justice system. So I really see that I could be a bridge to the justice system and help these people in the communities, because it's multifaceted. Then, you know, when these people are restored, and if, say, they have to go through one of these programs, the same model's drug court, mental health court that we have in Madison County, veterans court, and they graduate from these programs, then it's like, how could they get jobs? How could they get the GEDs? And these types of programs are multifaceted. We did a lot of work in Madison County also with truancy and a truancy court, catching these children that are first falling through the cracks when they become truant. And so these types of programs, I see a real opportunity for leadership to help people, because my passion really is public service and helping people.
Talking about budget issues here, do you think there are discretionary spending programs that should face steeper cuts than other parts of our federal budget?
I imagine there may be some out there, but right now I think that if you're talking about, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, those are sacrosanct and should be left alone.
Okay. Are there anything that should be reduced or cut by some amount that might be wasteful at this time?
Well, I think we always should look where if there's any type of waste and fraud. And as a judge, what I was able to do is bring people together and get things done. So that's the same philosophy that I would bring to the table if I am honored to be elected. And I think there are some programs going on, I think like HEAT, in where the U.S. Attorney's Office are looking at fraud in Medicare or Medicaid and cracking down on that. So sure, on those types of issues. But again, you know, Social Security should be protected.
With the president's health care law now in effect, what changes do you see with the health care in this country? Other ideas for health care reform?
Again, I think, you know, the president's law has been passed. So you just don't take a hike and you know, shut down the government because you don't like what you see. Again, I would draw back on who I was as a judge and again, bringing people together and trying to fix what's not working. I mean, if costs are being raised for middle-income families, that shouldn't happen. So let's look at areas. I think it's all unfolding now, and, you know, we had the bad rollout, but let's see what occurs. Let's see what's trending, and let's move forward and fix the problems. Let's not go backward.
Congress has been criticized for not doing enough to address gun violence. What would you like to see in a measure on that issue?
Well, I'd like to see, you know, that's an interesting question. I'd like to see the loophole closed on gun shows, because I talked to a woman at an event, and it was a few months ago, and her dad was murdered, and her dad's killer was getting paroled very soon, and it was a long time ago, but it was still very, very emotional for her, and she said to me, she said the thought of my dad's killer going to be able to get out and purchase a gun at a gun show it was devastating to her. We have gun laws here, and we have gun laws associated with, you know, being adjudicated mentally ill, which I think has come to the forefront. And right before I left as chief judge, I put together a task force of all the stakeholders involved in that in mental health issues. And because there are laws out there, and I always said communication and collaboration do not cost a dime. So, let's get together and let's try to, again, solve these problems, and then just give, you know, information from all our mental health providers, all our law enforcement providers, and also from a judicial perspective.
You stepped down from the bench to do this. So, it was kind of a quick turnaround. Do you miss being a judge?
Well, I was a judge for 18 years, and I miss very much the people and the relationships that had grown over the years. But I'm ready for a new change. And, you know, I one of my inspirations of doing this has been my children. I told you my daughter is a teacher, and my son also, when I was contemplating whether to get in this race, because it was a huge decision, I had the honor to see him be sworn in as a second lieutenant. And I saw that he wasn't afraid, and he was so proud to serve his country, and I thought I shouldn't be afraid to serve mine. So I am in this race. He is now an Army Ranger and just was deployed a few weeks ago to Kuwait. So I know there might be some dark days in this campaign, but I really draw inspiration because what I'm going through won't be really anything compared to what he's going through.
That was WILL's Jeff Bossert talking with former Chief Judge of Illinois' 3rd Judicial Circuit, Ann Callis. In the race for the Democratic nomination for the 13th District, David Green says he is the most progressive candidate. He's a policy analyst for the University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs. He told WILL's Sean Powers that he would bring a voice to Congress that is more representative of the rest of the country.
There are 60 or 70 members of the progressive caucus in the Democratic Party in Congress. I would certainly join that, but I would certainly be unique even in that context in various views that I have. You have a room full of cats and you send in a dog, the culture changes. I will be someone who stands on principle, and I will set an example of being elected on the basis of principle and ideas and analysis and criticism and vision. And that will be unique. If I was to win this primary, the national media would cover this district more than any other district in this country. A, because it's a sort of a 50-50 district, but B, because there would be a unique difference and a real substantive difference that you wouldn't find in any other district in this country where you will usually have two corporate candidates running.
What do you hope to achieve during your first term in Congress?
I hope to achieve voicing those views that so far have not been voiced in Congress, that are not seriously voiced. I agree with some of the views of the Progressive Caucus's back-to-work budget. I'm arguing for full employment, probably in an even more definite way than they are. But there are many views that are simply not heard in Congress that need to be heard, including anti-war voices, breaking down, disbanding our military bases around the world and bringing all of our troops home, promoting a just settlement between Israel and Palestine, which has so far been supported by every country in the world except Israel and the United States, an absolute ban on fracking. Two-thirds or more of the people want single-payer Medicare for all health care, but we don't get that. And people are discouraged because they think that they're ruled out of the political process in that regard.
You know, we talked a little bit moments ago about hydraulic fracturing, and I wanted to ask you, what policies related to the green economy do you support? And I guess what other concepts related to energy policy do you see playing a factor in our economy over the next decade?
Energy policy is a primary form, a form of investment and employment towards a future, a more efficient and responsible future. The government needs to be making massive in investments in wind and solar and renewable energy resources. Fracking is about corporate profits, and it's about destroying the environment and the earth for profit. It needs to stop.
When you look at the budget as a whole, I mean, where are there some necessary areas to cut?
Military spending, A, and B, healthcare spending that has been driven by a privatized healthcare system. The Medicare and Medicaid system should be expanded to include including all citizens of this country. And at that point, the $2.5 to $3 trillion we spend as a country on healthcare would become $1 trillion less. It would become more government spending, but less overall spending, leaving much more room for taxation and spending for other social programs.
So, you know, on the issue of the minimum wage, as you know, the federal rate is lower than the state rate here in Illinois.
Yeah.
How high should the federal rate be?
$15 an hour for starters. It should move rapidly to a $15 an hour wage, which would reflect the productivity gains over the last 40 years that have been achieved by workers, obviously using technology, which allows them. It isn't a matter of moral virtue. It's a matter of workers doing work in a much more productive way than they were, but not seeing benefits for it.
Immigration. The Senate passed a bipartisan immigration bill recently. It was you know, one of the chief sponsors was Dick Durbin, as you probably know, but it stalled in the House.
Yeah.
What should immigration reform look like?
Well, this is probably one of the issues which I had to do a little more than the research that I had already done in addressing this specific issue, because it's a difficult issue. Because, of course, like anything else, it's been exploited, say, by the high-tech industry, by the Silicon Valley, to allow more opportunities to import cheap foreign labor to compete with American high-tech workers. I adamantly support a quick and efficient and relatively painless path to citizenship for undocumented foreign workers and their families in this country, the 12 million or so of them that apparently are part of our workforce now. But again, please keep the larger issue in mind. The issue with Mexico is NAFTA. The issue is trade policies that have put American workers into competition with foreign workers, decimated the Mexican economy as well as our own economy, and sent Mexican and other Latin American workers to this country. There are, again, larger issues here. If we're only talking about, I mean, we need to deal with the people that are here and that should be allowed to stay here and then become full citizens of this country. But at a more fundamental level, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of country are we? How do we want to relate and trade to other countries in ways that benefit workers in both countries? Because these trade agreements, they're not free trade agreements. They're really investor rights agreements. Have benefited only corporations and not people in any countries, and that includes the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well. This is a corporate bill, not a worker bill.
But if that bill from the Senate does come up in the House and you're a member of the House, would you support it?
Yes, I would.
What do you see as the biggest strengths and challenges of our public education system today?
There are radical reforms that can be done to the way schooling is done. It's too authoritarian. It's too test-driven. All those things should be done. And then we would have a much more productive and relaxed system for children to learn and grow. Right now, we've created this kind of hothouse, and I think children feel that. And beyond that, we have this perverse system in which children are told that they have to compete for jobs and that they have to get more education in college and go into more debt. And student debt is a horrible problem. Higher education should be free. Students should be out of debt. They should be graduating from college with no debt. They should be graduating from graduate school with no debt.
So students shouldn't have to pay to go to college?
No, the government should pay. With another $150 billion a year, less than 1% of our GDP, we could provide free public ed for all the students who want it at the state level. It's not that much money. We need smaller class sizes. We need more individualized instruction. We need more arts, music, literature, as opposed to all this emphasis on science and math, which should remain. It just, there should be more of a balance there. Children should be able to pursue their interests and their passion without worrying about what the vocational results of it should be. Vocationalism has its place in schools. Children should graduate from high school and college with the basic skills that might be needed to begin to acquire other skills in the workplace. But that shouldn't be, schooling for work shouldn't be the central issue of our schools.
David Green spoke with WILL's Sean Powers. I'm Scott Cameron, and the final candidate we'll hear from this hour on Focus is a physics professor at the University of Illinois. He says education is a priority.
I'm an expert on diploma mills, on criminal businesses that sell fake degrees. So there was a lot of attention in the press to a case that I helped with, sent some bad people to prison. Legislation came about from the attention of the case, and that was I worked on basically legislation meant to tell the Federal Trade Commission to stop the sale of fake medical degrees, among other things.
Did that bill get passed?
Yeah, although it got banged up when it got to the Senate side, and it's tempting to think that the contributions flowing into the system from the owner of the largest diploma mill in the United States played a role in the weakening of the legislation.
Is this something you would look at addressing during your first term in Congress?
I think the most important issue in this district has to be returning the country to full employment. So I believe that in times of a real need to rebuild our infrastructure and in times when the government can borrow money inexpensively, we should be going gangbusters on fixing the things. It's like fixing the roof. If suddenly you can borrow money at no interest, you should fix your roof. You should fix your car. If you need a car to be able to get to work, you spend the money, you borrow the money to get your car running so that you can get it to work. I think that's the most important issue for the district. Other things that are also very, very crucial to deal with are the high cost of higher education, making sure that the Affordable Care Act is made to work well, pushing to move the Affordable Care Act to a single-payer system. These are things that affect the lives of people who are on the edge.
What is your interpretation of the role of government? And really, what should our tax dollars be paying for?
One of the great things that the government can do is to seek out talent that resides in the population and scout for things we should be trying. For example, ways to do better math remedial education. We see a few out there. They're in Kentucky. Ways to do energy production, ways to develop better solar cells, ways to reduce poverty in single-parent families. There are ideas out there that look promising. The federal government should be collecting these up, should be vacuuming up the good ideas.
How do they go about doing that? Should there be a committee that's vacuuming up these ideas? I mean, what do you suggest?
That would be one way of doing it. I had just been thinking that if I am elected, certainly the areas that I would be putting energy into working on, energy, science, technology, in Congress, we don't have a group of legislators who are either experts or non-experts but highly knowledgeable about science.
Is that something you would want to be part of and start?
I would start that.
You know, addressing our $16 trillion national debt will obviously require sacrifices from the public. What specific examples of federal spending or tax provisions would you recommend?
Why should we have someone who's being paid for doing a certain thing have, because of their ability to mess with the laws, have their income be identified as something that gets taxed as if it's a capital gain? Why should we allow capital gains to be taxed as anything other than income? I would say that if you're living on the money that your stocks are providing you, you should be taxed as if you had been paid that for going out and teaching kids in a classroom. So I'd say that I would like to have the capital gains tax be made the same as the tax on earned income. That's one thing. That will make a tremendous difference. Look what we had during the Clinton era. We had somewhat higher marginal tax rates on the most affluent Americans. We had tremendous surpluses. Then we got the Bush administration. We had tax cuts for the wealthy. We had wars that were being kept off the books, in a sense. And now we have a great deal more difficulty than before. We also have tolerance of the banks coming up with extraordinarily risky investment vehicles where no one can know what their risks are and then jeopardizing the financial safety of the whole world.
Well, are there specific examples of programs you would cut?
I think that the sort of subsidies for example, for the oil industry that distort the market are inappropriate. I don't see that we need to subsidize agribusiness at the expense, really, of small farm owners. So I think direct payments to incredibly wealthy farm corporations, Michelle Bachmann, for example, are harmful to us. I would cut those. I don't see that the weapon systems that are meant to fight a very high-tech war are the right way to spend defense money. We have to do the cuts in ways that preserve people's ability to earn a living.
What are some examples of these programs that I guess you would consider clearly wasteful or even subject to widespread fraud?
I think a lot of our defense appropriations stuff is that way. I think we see weapon systems that are initially bid based on an unrealistically low final price tag, which then go up and up and up. Those should not be allowed to continue. I would like very much to see the Affordable Care Act evolve into a much less expensive, much more effective
single-payer system.
Single-payer. Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. I don't see that we need to have, 30% of the resources flowing into the system be used for profit by insurance companies. We'd like to have something that's quite a bit less expensive and more effective, and that would be single-payer.
Well, you know, now that the Affordable Care Act is in effect, I'm wondering what other changes would you like to see with healthcare in this country?
We want to take a good close look at the problems as they arise. For example, it seemed to have come as a surprise that some people actually did lose access to the insurance that they had had because those programs were substandard. We'd like to fix things that people discover that are problems with this. We'd like to really cause the federal government to be allowed to negotiate on the prices for pharmaceuticals. There's no reason that Americans should be paying so much more for a particular drug than a Canadian, or that it is now illegal to import things from Canada that you could buy in the United States but at a much higher price.
We just passed the one-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook elementary school shootings. Congress has been criticized for not doing enough as it relates to gun violence. What would you like to see happen in this area?
That's such an interesting question. Okay, let me start by saying what the obligation of a member of Congress is in addition to representing the people in the district. It's to uphold the laws. And that means as interpreted by the courts, as interpreted by the Supreme Court. The Roberts Court says that the Second Amendment means that people can keep guns. So that's what we work with. People have a right to keep and bear firearms. That does not mean that the federal government or the state governments are unable to regulate them. I spent a lot of time at county fairs during the summer, mostly listening. And a lot of people talked to me about guns. Except for one person, everybody I spoke to thought that we should have universal background checks, that it was fine to make sure that people knew how to handle their guns safely. I think we should view this as an opportunity to identify what the sources of gun danger are. There are these terrible, terrible things that happen, but I think there's a lot more death in the world associated with children, shooting children by accident, or other things that happen in the home. So we should begin to chip away at the dangers through regulation and incentives to have people say, I ought to get a trigger lock because it'll, you know, I'll get a little bit of money back in my taxes.
Oh, so providing some sort of tax credit if you, for example, get a trigger lock or something that'll improve the chances of safety when using a firearm.
Okay, two things about that. One is that I think we want to have data to back up every single public policy decision we make. So first, do trigger locks really help? My guess is they do. But we would want to know what the data show. The second thing is, do the incentives help?